Brittany.
And I'm Heidi. And this is Transforming Together, a podcast from HopeWorks. And before we get started today, we wanted to make a brief HopeWorks announcement. We are actually moving locations very, very soon. We will be closed at our normal office on Friday the 24th, Monday the 27th, and we'll open up at our new location on Tuesday the 28th of March at 9770 Patuxent Woods, Suite 300. And this is really close to the intersection of Snowden River and Broken Land Parkway, so we hope that you'll see us at our new location soon.
Yeah.
So with that announcement out of the way, let's get started with today's topic.
Yeah. So today we are transforming the way that we think and talk about survivors of violence who are undocumented immigrants. This was always a plan for Heidi and I to talk about the intersections of gender-based violence and immigration, but it just felt really timely given this current moment, both with what's happening administratively, but also with the way that that's playing out on the ground. There is a specific story that we want to highlight and go into, but really quickly just wanting to mention that HopeWorks, regardless of immigration status or documentation, will always serve survivors in Howard County. Just wanting to be really clear and plain about that. But there is a specific story that kind of inspired Heidi and I to tackle this conversation today. We're talking about Irvine Gonzalez, a transgender survivor based in El Paso, Texas. Can you tell me a little bit more about what you know about Irvine?
Sure. So we know that Irvine was arrested at the El Paso County Courthouse on February 9th. She was there seeking a protective order from her abusive partner, which I think we mentioned in our last podcast, but a protective order is kind of like a restraining order, is what you might hear it called on TV, to get protection from someone who's been abusive. Right after she was granted that protective order from the judge, from her abusive boyfriend, her lawyer whispered to her, "Are you ready? ICE, Immigration Customs and Enforcement, is right outside the courthouse, and we're going to walk you outside, and then they're going to arrest you."
Yeah.
And so she was there seeking protection from her abuser, and she was arrested by immigration. We also know that in reports of that case on February 9th, she was repeatedly misgendered. As Brittany mentioned, Irvine is a trans woman, and she was repeatedly called by the wrong pronouns. We don't know for sure whether she's being detained in a men's facility or a women's facility, but we do know that for about more than 2 weeks, she was denied her critical hormone treatment for her her gender. And we know that she was in this abusive relationship. So Brittany, can you tell me a little bit more about what we know about the state of her abuse?
So yeah, actually in various reports that I read, this was actually her abusive ex-partner. And she was living in a shelter at the time that she was seeking her protective order. And while she was at the courthouse, she was being accompanied by her case manager. We really feel like this is important to note because Ms. Gonzalez is someone who was seeking services. She went through the quote unquote normal pathway for getting help and getting protection and then was arrested. So we have to think about the messages that that sends, what that communicates to folks, both indirectly and directly. And it's important to understand that her documentation status was utilized by her ex-boyfriend as a tactic of her abuse. We know that he was brutally beating her, but we also know that he was psychologically abusive and manipulative.
And part of that was in large part based on her immigration status and holding that over her head.
Yeah.
Because he himself is a U.S. citizen.
Yeah.
We actually have a quote from Ms. Gonzalez from an interview that she did through her lawyer from The New Yorker. And let me find it. It says that this is something he always threatened me with. He would tell me that if I reported him to the police, they would only believe him because he's a U.S. citizen and not me. Mm-hmm. And that's a really common form of what we would call identity abuse, where someone's being manipulated or controlled based on their immigration status. And this is the type of psychological manipulation and control that we see all the time with people coming into HopeWorks. So even though this case took place across the country, mm-hmm. we're really feeling it and having it hit home for the work that we do here in Howard County.
Yeah. And just to be like really transparent, you know, there are conservative news reports or even ICE that tried to use Ms. Gonzalez's criminal record as a means to justify arresting her at the moment where she was most vulnerable and seeking help. But that's problematic for many reasons. Issa Noyola, who is a program director at the Transgender Law Center, says it very eloquently, that they're looking at her criminal history in a very linear and basic way. They're not acknowledging the circumstances that can drive an individual to feel that they have to make these choices in order to survive. And to not acknowledge the violence that trans women face, trans immigrant women in particular, is a failure of how this whole situation arose. We have to understand that with trans folks, with undocumented folks, with people who are living at those intersections, they are living under a very specific set of constraints that limits mobility and the ability to make choices, which is a really great segue to kind of talk about what we experience at HopeWorks, but just in the nonprofit world in general, in terms of barriers to receive services. Can you talk more about that, Heidi?
Yeah. So I really want to emphasize that it was a failure of the system, and that when she was arrested by ICE, it was not for the other criminal records that she has, but because someone had identified her as being in the U.S. illegally, which we're fairly certain was the abuser who left that tip. So there's a wide variety of reasons why any survivor of violence might have a hard time accessing services or might be hesitant to seek them out. But those barriers are often amplified significantly, and additional challenges are included for survivors who are also undocumented immigrants. Lots of immigrants who are coming to a new place in the U.S. from their home country experience a lot of isolation. If they're not coming specifically to connect with a family or friends network, they often may not know anyone at all or have a way to access services via someone to translate for them or just to tell them what services exist. And especially if they're coming with an abusive partner, mm-hmm. that partner is controlling all the access that they have to other resources and outside information. They could even be coming to the U.S. because they're seeking asylum from or fleeing gender-based violence already or other violence in their home country. And then they come here and are experiencing limited access to resources and more barriers and often sometimes more violence because of that lack of access. Mm-hmm. The racism and discrimination that already exists in our country is often amplified for immigrants who don't know how to navigate the system, or they're discriminated against both on an interpersonal level and on a systemic level because mm-hmm. of their documentation status. There's also a wide variety of other barriers, and there's fear, we know from this case in El Paso, that the fear of your immigration status being discovered and being deported is an enormous reason why mm-hmm. someone wouldn't come forward and seek services. We know from an article in the Huffington Post that at least 6 women in El Paso alone who were going to seek protective orders have pulled their cases and are no longer seeking that important protection that we want to offer to all survivors because they're afraid of the same thing happening to them mm-hmm. as happened to Irvine Gonzalez and being detained or deported, rather, which could be sending them back to an even more violent situation. We don't know. Or regardless, they were seeking protection because they were being abused, and instead they were experiencing being detained by the state instead of receiving help.
Mm-hmm. Which is really like another form of violence.
Absolutely. And they're often experiencing violence within the detention centers. I would consider Irvine Gonzalez not having access to the hormonal medication she needs a form of violence from the state for not offering her providing her her essential medication. Yeah. That's absolutely unconscionable. And so then the other biggest thing that we can think of that's a barrier that may seem like the most obvious, but is also the oftentimes the hardest thing for service providers to get over, is lack of language access. Mm-hmm. And that's something that HopeWorks is working on a lot, that we're not perfect at. What we want, what we're trying to work towards, is something called language access, which there's a really fabulous resource named Many Languages, One Voice, and they define language access as when a person who doesn't speak English very well receives the exact same services as a person who does speak English well. And so that's what we're working towards. Brittany, why don't you speak to why that is so important, that language access exists?
It affects so many things. At its core, language is how we communicate with one another. When I think about how this applies to the work that I have done at HopeWorks, first and foremost, it's that first contact. You know, it's that first time that someone gathers the courage to call, or the first time that someone is able to get transportation and walk through our front door. If they walk into our waiting room and we are unable to communicate with them, unable to find out what they need, unable to find out what they're looking for, unable to find out what they've experienced, then, you know, despite our best intentions, that sends a message to someone that this place is not for me.
And this is after they've hopped over all those barriers that I just mentioned, trying to even get to the place, and then they get there and they can't communicate with anyone.
Exactly. And yeah. And it goes back to that idea of first impressions. And then, you know, in a really practical way, there's forms, you know, which speaks to the difference between translation and interpretation. They're not the same thing. Translation is written. Interpretation is verbal and oral. So can someone fill out the forms? Can they fill out the intake form? Can they successfully fill out the referral form? I might have someone helping me try to, you know, translate, but then there's also the fact that sometimes my language cannot be translated in English. Or you have case management, you know, ongoing support where you're supposed to meet with someone and talk. I've had experiences at the Safe House where I had to do that very important process with a language access line. And you make it work and you do what you need to do, but there's something lost in the rapport building. When I think about other services we provide, like counseling and legal support, you know, counseling has its own language. There's, you know, there's these psychological terms, and then legal, you've got legal jargon. Sometimes those are languages that are not even accessible to proficient English speakers.
Right.
You know? Yeah. So trying then to translate complicated English language into accessible different language is frustrating and definitely a growth point, I think, for many, many organizations. All of that just combines to be a lack of knowledge of how to navigate systems. And it's that lack of knowledge that abusive partners will really prey on. Well, you don't know the legal system the way that I do. Well, I have this certification that says you can't do that. Like, you know, it could be complete bull, but if you don't know left from right, then it doesn't matter what I'm telling you. I'm utilizing that lack of knowledge to manipulate you. And what this ultimately comes down to is dignity. Are we honoring the experience and the knowledge and the wisdom of the people who walk through our doors and their primary language is not English? So language access is huge, and it's definitely a growth point for us.
And I would say even that is the first step. Just translating things verbatim or interpreting verbatim isn't covering all the basis. We also need to have, there's frequently the term that's used is cultural proficiency, but I recently received a training from the Asian and Pacific Islanders Domestic Violence Institute of Maryland, I believe is their name.
Oh, DVRP? Domestic Violence Resource Project.
Yes, but they're specifically for Asian American and Pacific Islander communities, and they call it instead cultural humility, which I love because it's the idea that you can never, as an organization, truly be proficient on every single culture of every single person who walks in your door. But what you can do is be humble and listening and learning to what your clients are telling you and responding to their needs. And that can be things like what an organization is called may not necessarily be culturally relevant. So I know that there's a fantastic organization that we love in California called Mujeres Unidas y Activas, which means women united and active. And that's actually a intimate partner violence and sexual violence resource center, but it's not called that because in the clientele that they're working with, that's not what they're going to respond to as clearly. And so that's an even larger learning process. So
yeah, you're right, because even the term domestic violence can be a deterrent for people to come forward. There's either, oh, well, my community doesn't experience domestic violence, or I don't want to be associated with having gone to a place like that for help.
Exactly.
So that importance of language and how we frame things and how we structure things. There was a piece that you wanted to mention about that.
Yeah. So you might have noticed throughout our podcast already today, Brittany and I have been using the word undocumented to describe immigrants who don't have citizenship or permanent resident status. And that's really important to us to use the word undocumented immigrant instead of illegal or alien for a variety grave reasons coming down primarily to just respecting people, we fundamentally believe that no human being can be illegal. They have fundamental rights to exist. They have fundamental human rights, regardless of the way that they came into a country. They are living there, and they are with the intention possibly of permanence, and they have the right to be respected. Also, they're not coming from outer space. They're not coming from a different planet. They're not aliens. While that may be a legal term that's used sometimes when we're talking to and about people, we never want to other them or make them feel less than human or unhuman in some way. So that vocabulary term may not seem like a big deal, but we think it's a really important piece in respecting everyone's dignity and worth. And that's something that we want to pay attention to when people are coming to receive services at HopeWorks.
And that's something that Heidi and I are always going to be intentional about in every podcast, because that is how we do this work. That is how we at HopeWorks can engage with this work in a practical way, you know, aside from service provision, by being intentional about the language that we use. You can show someone by respecting pronouns or by respecting terminology that you see them and that you understand them, that you hear them. That could be the difference between making or breaking a trusting relationship with someone.
And if we ever mess it up on the podcast, feel free to call us out. Yeah. We're transforming together on all of this. We want to be getting better and finding ways to treat people with more humanity and more respect, and with that idea of cultural humility and humility in our approach in all things.
Yeah. What this usually means is adapting our services to meet different needs. And when we are thinking about the special needs of immigrant survivors, you know, we do something at HopeWorks called safety planning, which is exactly what it sounds like. You are making a plan to stay safe, whether it's a survivor and their children, or just a survivor or a survivor and their pet. And you can plan to stay safe while you're still in the home or still in the relationship. We safety plan with folks around leaving. We safety plan with folks around after they have made a transition or separated. You know, sometimes that involves someone packing a bag with important documents, birth certificates, medical information, things like that. One special consideration that we need to think about for undocumented survivors is a child care plan. You know, what happens if one or both parents is detained and or deported? There's an example from the media. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So I don't know if anyone has, probably some people listening to this podcast, hopefully, have heard of Diane Guerrero, who is an actress right now on both the TV shows Jane the Virgin and Orange is the New Black. She plays Maritza on Orange is the New Black, if that helps you remember who she is. She was born in the United States, but her parents were undocumented immigrants and her brother were undocumented immigrants from Colombia. And she came home one day at 14 years old, coming home from school, to find her house abandoned. And she did not know until she went to a neighbor that her parents and her brother had been detained and were very shortly after that deported. And I can't imagine just coming home after a day of school and my family's gone. I can't even wrap my head around that. And she fortunately had a really strong community around her who were willing.
Her neighbors, right?
Her neighbors and other community members. No other family members, just the neighbors who were able to kind of step in and help her make sure that she could still go to school, that she could have a safe place to stay and be cared for. But she's someone who just totally fell through the cracks. And there was no one. Oftentimes, maybe children will be taken into the foster care system or into other systems. But she was someone who fell through the cracks. And survivors are really concerned about that. They're really concerned about, what if I am at the court? And even though it's been unprecedented before, now there's a precedent. I could be arrested walking out the door. What happens to my kids? And unfortunately, because of the inconsistent political climate that we're in right now, HopeWorks couldn't necessarily offer a concrete, we know this is what's going to happen, but we can plan for that. We can talk about that and try to have the person we're engaging with feel safer or feel more confident about what might happen next.
And it's important to talk about the children and the idea of what would happen to the children, because that is something that abusive partners will very often play on. If you're gone, then I've got the kids and you have no access to them. You know, they very often use children as tools to manipulate their partner. It also makes me think about, what about youth who don't have supportive adults to step in should something happen? Because foster care or quote unquote the streets, these are also sites of violence, very often sexual violence for young people. So there are just so many ways in which all of these issues are connected. Another consideration is that there are some pathways to citizenship. There are protections for immigrant victims. In the case of Irvine, you know, you would think that she would have access to potentially going the U visa route. But with the U visa, you have to help law enforcement prosecute the abuser. And it's a lengthy process. So it's so unrealistic for people who are experiencing crisis.
Right. So what a U visa is it's an option where survivors who do, if they're willing to collaborate and work with the police to prosecute their abuser, they can have a long-term route to citizenship through that. But yes, as you mentioned, it takes years. And there's lots of reasons why working with law enforcement might not be or feel safe mm-hmm. to that survivor. And also, even if the person we're working with, maybe that route to citizenship or maybe any other route that we might be able to point them to may not be the route that they want to go, may not be what feels safe or okay for them. And it's really important to us to be thinking about how, regardless if someone's even working to citizenship or not, if that's something even on their radar mm-hmm. when they're in crisis or even moving out of crisis, it's not our job to judge that. It's our job to help them know about legal routes if they want that. But our primary concern at HopeWorks is the safety mm-hmm. of that person.
And certainly you can think of legal status as being a part of safety. But I think what's key for Heidi and I, you know, there's something called respectability politics. I don't have an eloquent definition for that. But with respect to the idea of legal immigrants versus illegal immigrants, it's what comes up in the imagination for you. It's the same way when you think of survivors. There is an idea of the good survivor, who a survivor is, what she or they look like. And if you don't fit into that narrative, then sometimes you're less pitiable, or sometimes folks are less willing to help you because you don't fit that good immigrant or that good survivor narrative.
And we can think of that in terms of Irvine's story, because
yes.
she has that criminal record. People say, well,
yeah.
you know, she has a criminal record. We don't know, her abuser could have been a part of building that criminal record, but even if he wasn't,
yeah.
she still deserves to be safe and to be protected as a survivor of violence, and we fundamentally believe that.
Yeah. So that kind of just segues into, in general, there are some very real barriers that prevent not only undocumented folks, but women of color in general and communities of color from approaching or entering systems. Just in general, sometimes you have cultures or religious affiliation where it restrains a survivor from leaving an abusive relationship or involving outsiders. You know, when I think about my community with Native Hawaiian families, you don't air your dirty laundry. You know, you take care of things in-house, and it's that silencing that can be so isolating. But at the same time, let me tell you, I don't want anyone saying that my culture is inherently more violent than another culture. And so that's another barrier. That's another reason why someone might not want to come forward, because they don't want the mistakes of one person to then reflect on their entire cultural community. And we very often see that happen, where one person from one group does something and then we're making generalizations about an entire community of people.
And that can also translate to reasons why they might not want to go back to their home country if that's presented as an option. I remember a story from the DVRP, the organization we referenced earlier, where someone was saying, there's no way I can go home, because yeah. if I go home and I reveal that I left my abusive partner,
yeah.
that won't be accepted back home. They will yeah. not accept me for that. So that can be an additional fear for going back to their home country as an option, or an additional fear related to deportation.
Yeah.
If I'm deported, I have to tell them that this was happening.
Yeah, exactly. Another thing is that there's a lack very often of service providers that look like the survivor or share common experiences. It's again, are we communicating directly or indirectly that this is a space for someone? And I know that if I walk in somewhere and I don't see anyone who I can see myself in, then that sends a message that maybe this might not be the safest place for me. Maybe they won't understand me. Maybe this is just a waste of time. You know, there are things like racism and fears around law enforcement. Whatever side of the fence you fall on, there are histories that inform those fears. We make assumptions based on ethnicity and et cetera. And so all of these things come together to result in very often folks underreporting or failing to seek services. And this is something that HopeWorks need, and other places everywhere, we need to be mindful about. How do we limit those barriers, and how do we increase access?
Absolutely. And we want to take the last few minutes of our podcast to bring this back home to Howard County. We had an opportunity earlier this year in Howard County where a bill was proposed by two county councilmen, Calvin Ball and Jen Tarasa, to declare Howard County a sanctuary community. And the bill initially passed, but was vetoed by the county executive, Howard Kittleman, Alan Kittleman. We live in Howard County and he's Alan Kittleman. And it was vetoed by him, and then it was not overturned when the opportunity arose. So we're not going to talk about the what ifs if that had passed, because the opportunity has passed and it would have had its challenges and its benefits. On one hand, it could have been a really important symbolic gesture to show the immigrant community the support that we have for them. But on the other hand, we've heard from some survivors that they are worried that it would have put a target on their backs as survivors of violence in a sanctuary community where there potentially could be more crackdown and more backlash.
Yeah.
But we want to highlight that the immigrant population is the fastest growing population in Howard County, and that because of that, we as HopeWorks stand with all survivors of violence, with the undocumented people in our communities. And that is a large and growing community that is underserved, and that we need to improve and grow in our services to support them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that we really need to be clear about who we as a community are. And just one of the most basic things that we can do is have these conversations. You know, Heidi and I are going to continue our work, and we're going to continue to look for ways to be more accessible. But these conversations right here, challenging our assumptions, being intentional about our language, being willing to admit when we have made a mistake. These are really simple things that we can do, but they are so impactful. So I just really want to thank you for being willing to go down into this topic with me. I know we were both a little bit nervous about it, but really felt that it was an important conversation to have.
So since we have a little bit more time at the end of the podcast, we want to share some more information with you about what HopeWorks has going on and more ways that you can get involved in our community. I run HopeWorks Youth Leadership Project, and if you or someone you know is a teenager ages 14 to 18 who identifies as a woman, trans person, or non-binary person, we will be already now, we are accepting applications for the fall class of Youth Leadership, which is a program that meets once a month, September through May, to really dive into these issues on a deeper level for the teens in our community so they can be advocates for healthy relationships in their communities and really engage deeply in conversations about social justice issues. So that application information is available on HopeWorks' website, and you can always call us for more information. I'm really looking forward to engaging with a new group of teens in the fall.
I know. I really love the youth leaders that you have this year, and I like having them in our office. Another quick announcement is that coming up on Saturday, April 29th, we have our annual fundraiser called Hope Bowl. So you get together with a team and you guys work to raise about $500. There are prizes and there's music and there's food. And it's just it's a great opportunity for folks to connect and raise funds. You know, those funds are unrestricted. And so there's so much possibility in terms of how we can support our clients and survivors with unrestricted funds. So we would really love to see a great turnout this year.
And you could potentially meet Brittany and myself and yeah, see how bad we are at bowling.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that would be great.
And just one more reminder that HopeWorks is moving. You will not find us in our usual place, but rather at 9770 Patuxent Woods Parkway. And we hope to see you there soon.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, everyone, for listening and engaging today, and we'll be back next month.
Yes, thanks.